On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Borderlines from the Irish Times with me, Mary Minahan.
And me, Freya McClements.
This podcast is about changing identities north and south, with one presenter on either side of the border chatting to a guest who gets it.
And our guest today is Seamus O'Reilly, the author of the best-selling memoir, Did You Hear Mammy Died? And Seamus really does get it because you grew up pretty much right on the border, didn't you? And I wonder, could you describe for us, first of all, just where you grew up and what that was like?
Thanks for having me, first off. And now I will give you my exact geographical location. I grew up between Derry and Donegal, very literally in the between part. It's the old Letterkenny Road kind of neck of the woods. So the closest townland would probably be Carrigans on the Donegal side, or maybe Calais. So you're kind of going out towards Lifford, basically. But the closest on the Derry side would still be the city, so it's really in the sticks. It doesn't have like a little village hall or like a little GA club or anything. So all of our sort of growing up kind of curricular activities, school, everything, church, that was all in the city. That was all in sort of the Bishop Street, Bog side, and then schools elsewhere. So we grew up very much feeling like we were Derry people as opposed to County Derry people, even though geographically we were in the countryside. And we were also so specifically on the border that my dad's fence was literally the border. So anything that went over the fence, we had to, you know, probably should have been filling out forms to grab it. But I've actually done the maths for it. And my dad's fence, which he erected to stop a horse from eating his flowers, is 0.04% of the UK's border. With the Republic of Ireland and or the EU now. Yeah, so this was something that was of negligible interest to anybody who knew us growing up. It wasn't something we thought about. We would cross the border without realizing it. You know, anytime, you know, the closest pub to us is about a 40, 50 minute walk away, and it's a windy, windy road up. You know, you go over the border and back without being told about 12 or 13 times. And when I was a kid, I remember when phones first came out, when I was about 16 or 17, I was allowed a phone, and it was like really in the Nokia sort of, you know, WAP, you know, playing Snake kind of days. Whatever the sort of the usage, like notifications you get saying, welcome to Ireland. Please note that this costs blah, blah, blah. And then, it would, you know, when you went back, you know, home, quote unquote, it would say, welcome back to the UK. Just remember that you can blah, blah, blah. So you'd wake up and, like, I don't know if it was wind. I don't know if it was magnetic solar winds or whatever, but you'd wake up with 14 different text messages from your stationary phone, you know, beside your bed or charging, would have left the jurisdiction so many times and come back. So we grew up.
I hope you weren't being charged for that.
I'm sure we almost certainly were. But it was all top up, so you knew every single penny you had. You had 14p, so you know you could call your friend that you just seen all day in school and talk nonsense with. That's all it was. It was sort of one of those negligible, funny things. People would come out to my house and be like, oh, there's Donegal. But like, as everybody who grew up in that time knows, the idea of it being a different country was kind of really not something people thought about. Loads of people worked on one side, lived in the other one, went to school in one, whatever. Half the people on my bus home from school would go straight on to Donegal. So it was a separation that was almost like a factoid. It was like that's funny. That was it. And then it was not something I ever even talked about with, like, when I moved to London 11 years ago and would be talking about myself and, you know, my old family history and all that. It just wasn't something that really came up until about 5 years ago, when everyone in Britain realized that they had a 300 mile long border with the institution that they'd just separated themselves from. And so I wrote a big piece about that on Twitter, a very angry one, which is, I cringe slightly to read back now, because it was a more sincere and earnest time for Twitter. So it was a numbered thread that was very full of capital letters and bluster. But I was very upset and angry about how people hadn't talked about the border as a thing. And it now seems strange because it became such a part of the process and such a part of the conversation. But up to and after the referendum, like, it was never mentioned. Nobody visited Northern Ireland. Nobody talked about it. It was brought up once on Question Time, one time for like 40 seconds. And to me, it was infuriating. And I was already writing for the Irish Times and the Guardian here and there about those issues, sort of very tangentially, about like mostly writing other stuff. But I started writing more stuff about it, I think, because they just didn't know anyone else from Northern Ireland, which I'm kind of over-egging, but maybe not by much. And certainly the people they had writing about Northern Ireland were either writing extremely dry stuff because possibly they were terrified of offending anyone, or because they just didn't know very much. And so I started then writing a bit more about that. And the number one response I would get was from people who literally had not realized that there was a border. I mean, these are all English people. The Irish people all knew. But it was very, very strange. It's weird that only in those last 5 and 6 years have I started thinking more about what it means and what effects it's had, both in my life beforehand and also ever since. And also how much, you know, our closest neighbours don't know anything about us. So, yeah.
Seamus, just to look back at your younger days, I have very happy memories of seeing the O'Reilly bus coming to Mass at the Long Tower with you all on board. And you're absolutely right that everyone in Derry does date themselves with reference to the member of the O'Reilly family that they were in school with. I was Dara. I was one of the bigs. My brother was Shane. And my youngest brother, I think, was Dervla. So the O'Reilly bus, though, would have done a checkpoint run every morning. Can you describe what happened during those for the uninitiated and how normal it seemed then, and how does it seem in retrospect?
That's a really stirring kind of memory for me. I'm one of 11, as Mary is alluding to, and I'm ninth in the line. So we were all kind of quite close in age. There was 11 of us in 15 years, and it necessitated us getting to school in a minibus, which is exactly as mortifying as it sounds. It was nicknamed the O'Reilly Mobile. You know, we looked ridiculous, but the whole thing was made even more mortifying by the fact that for all of my primary school years and the beginning of my secondary school years, and the 10 years before that, before I can really remember anything, the only way you could get into Derry, where we all went to school, you'd have to go through a checkpoint in Nixon's Corner. And it wasn't a particularly taxing thing sort of physically. It was, you know, it could sometimes take just, you know, a minute, but it did involve, you know, lads with machine guns and dogs sometimes getting out the little mirror on a stick and looking under the car, or in our case, the minibus, and checking to see that my dad had decided to put explosive material beneath his children's feet for the day, you know? So that was obviously a striking thing, but as I go into in the book I wrote about my childhood, it was just completely normal. It was just one of those things that just happened. They might as well have been, you know, wiping our windshields, you know, and you know, they could have, or like trying to sell us a copy of the Evening Herald or something. It didn't seem like this crazy thing. And also because we'd been stewed in the army and in soldiers and in that sort of queasy paranoia of barbed wire and sandbags, in a way that it was just a hindrance. It was just something that we had to get through. But I do remember my dad being, you know, slightly tense sometimes, not because he had explosives in the car, I should point out, but just because it is an imposition, and it was a very concrete reminder that you were in a disputed space. You were in a disputed territory. And as I was going through my memories of this and talking about it with more people, the thing that really struck me was just how normal I had considered it. Because looking back at it now, just imagining a 5 or 6 year old kid just sitting there with your mum with a handlebar mustache and a machine gun, you know, barking kind of at my dad for documents and stuff. Because not necessarily because they were trying to intimidate, you know, I'll give them sort of the better show of will, and just presume maybe sometimes they were having a bad day, they were busy, they were annoyed about something, but it was intimidating, and it was something that was completely normal. And which, when I now try to explain to people, you know, my age and younger who were from other places, or even people from Derry who are like 10 years younger, they find it very hard to believe that that was part of our primary school experience. So yeah, it was a big flag in your head saying, this place is disputed. This place, is contested. You know, it's not as easily, transgressible between as we might think. You know, it was a little reminder that there are lines on this map and they're, you know, they're a bit more solid than we kind of like to think in our day and daily life.
It's funny, isn't it, that normality, and myself and Mary have talked about this, and we've talked about this with other guests on the podcast, and you brought back a memory for me there actually that I'd forgotten, and it was that same thing. It was being stopped at a checkpoint on the way to school as a primary school child, I imagine. But I remember on this particular day, we weren't stopped. We were waved on, and other cars were being stopped. And I asked my mum, why didn't they stop us and they stopped other cars? And she said, well, because they know that a woman isn't going to have a bomb in the car when she's just got her children in the car, you know? And I just kind of went, all right, yeah, you know. And when you look back on that, you think that's completely crazy that you would even be having that conversation as a primary school child, or that they would even think that your dad would, you know, that there would be kind of anything in that situation with you all in the car. But it's this idea of normality. But it was very interesting what you were saying in terms of the effect that this had on everybody, because I think you're the youngest guest that we've had so far on the podcast, and people I think would look at you as sort of almost part of that Good Friday Agreement generation. You know, you would have been what, 11 or 12 I think when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, but actually what you're saying is that this cast a shadow over everybody, or perhaps not a shadow but had an impact on everybody, and I presume still does. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of always preface these things with exactly that. So I was 13 when the Good Friday Agreement was signed. I think Lyra McKee, the late great Lyra McKee, wrote quite movingly about the sort of ceasefire babies. I think she was a little bit younger than I was. And I do think that's true. I had a very different experience even than my older brothers and sisters, let alone my dad, who didn't get the inalienable right to vote until he was 30. You know, I can't tell that story, and it doesn't behoove me to. And I think any time I talk about things like a checkpoint run or the little skirmishes and bomb scares and stuff that I went through, that, you know, this was in the good times. You know, this was in the slow fade and the wind down into the sort of uneasy sometimes, but at least stable peace that has existed since, with lots of caveats in there about, you know, just how rosy things are and have been for the last 2 decades. But it's a completely different thing to, you know, my dad was stopped and searched every time he went into a shop, you know, when he was in college in Belfast, you know, as a young man going into a record store, you know, he'd be patted down for, I don't know, nail bombs or whatever. Like, and he tells me those stories and I have the same reaction that sort of younger people have when I say things about checkpoint. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, every day. That was every single day. But having said that, because I've always prefaced things like this, and if you grow up in Derry and all of the older people are telling you the bad old days, and not only that, but they've earned their cynicism and they've earned their joy at things changing, you know, in such a way that I discounted a lot of the experiences. And it was only when I started writing more that I was like, oh yeah, there was a bomb that went off the top of our road when I was 3. that's not something I've ever talked about or thought about. I wasn't even told about it until I was an adult, not because I was being sheltered from it, because it just wasn't something that was even noteworthy. I think when it was in August of 88, the customs checkpoint was right, as I said, we're literally right on the border. So the customs checkpoint for the UK was just at the top of our land, and right across the street was the Republic of Ireland. And like, they got on fairly well. I think they had their lunches together and stuff. You know, they were just bored out of their minds on this country road. And then one weekend, someone tossed in like one of those sort of Quality Street bombs, you know, that kind of where you literally drive slowly up and you'd throw it in. And it blew up. It's like one of those horrible little prefab sort of huts it was. And it blew a wall into our field with sink still attached. So this is like, we're not even talking 20 feet away from our kitchen window, like we're looking directly out into it. So that was something when I told my wife about that, she was like, what? Well, why have you never told me this? This is completely insane. I was like, I've never thought about it. I just remember being told, and the windows rattled for a bit, and I think we had to go and stay at my granny's. And yeah, it was just like, even the Derry Journal covered it 3 days later, because it came out on a Tuesday, And it was on like page 13. It was on like, it was, there was 11 other bombs. And obviously, you know, I know a little bit about having to, fight for notice among 11 other things in my family. So it was just, there's sort of the throwaway quality of these things. And the fact that my dad did kind of protect us from things, obviously, because he's, you know, a dad, but he would also have to explain, like you were describing, he'd have to explain completely insane things. And every morning we listened to the radio, it would be BBC Radio Foyle. And, you know, he wouldn't let us watch like super violent cartoons, for example, but we would hear a roll call of the dead every morning, like every single morning. And it would just say such and such Catholic murdered, such and such Protestant murdered. And that sort of click track of just death being passed over as if it was literally the football scores, mm-hmm. you know, with so little emotion in the voice, because, you know, that's not really the job of a local radio bulletin, maybe to just be constantly stirring people up with sort of anger and horror. But like when you're describing, you know, horrible things in such a deadpan way, then, you know, that trickles into you. That's just something you take for granted by definition, because it's all you've known. So by the time things had kind of quietened down, particularly when I was going into like sort of the latter part of secondary school, it was kind of remarkable how different my experience was from, say, my older brothers and sisters who are like maybe 9 or 10 years mm-hmm. older, because, you know, there was a sense that things were getting better and things were changing. There was, you know, real kind of hope and optimism. I mean, when I was in school while John Hume and Seamus Heaney both got their Nobel Prizes, I think, within a few years, and that was my old school. They were in the same school as me, but they were a few years ahead, I should point out.
It's in columns.
Yes. And so there was that feeling of optimism. There was a feeling like this is a moment for the place, and we were aware of it. We, you know, that we didn't take for granted. You know, we saw that these things were, you know, were good. And then you kind of also saw, it's all the same people in politics. It's all the same people who've been saying the same things, and they just kept saying the same things. So there was a sort of an uneasy optimism that I think none of my older brothers and sisters possibly ever had the luxury of having when they were kids. And so maybe that was a difference. If I had to give one, is that we had that break around about 99, 2000 and onwards, where it felt like, oh, is this actually happening? Is this actually going to get better? But what you have to disentangle then is, what is a society like if it's had the opposite of that for 30 years?
Yeah, it's far from normal. You've written about coming into your teens when the worst of the troubles was finally receding, but that queasy paranoia, as you called it, was still everywhere around. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? And also the sectarianism that you've referenced, that you saw everywhere growing up, and it wasn't so much religious as tribal. And that was something that outside chroniclers of the Troubles rarely got right, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I always used to just make me really irk, especially on like otherwise good TV shows. Like, I remember at ER, there was a guy who said that the Bogside was in Belfast. I was like, come on, you could look that up. And I believe there was another guy who was like a Northern Irish photojournalist who was a sort of side character in the West Wing, and he got loads of things wrong. And also it's always portrayed like it was a religious war, like it was Sunnis and Shiites, where like, or like the Catholic and Protestant, capital C, capital P, was somehow over Holy Writ. And to me, it always seemed like it was a thought terminating cliche. It was designed so that you could make this seem intractable, illogical and irrational. And it's just two groups of crazy people who just believe the one weird religion and another weird religion, and they're fighting each other, when it was very clearly not that. You know, it was a land-based territorial dispute, which had an awful lot of cultural coding because of the accident of religion being part of it. But to me, it seemed sort of very dense to view it through that lens, and it struck me how otherwise sensible and serious people would kind of represent it that way. That being said, there was also an awful lot of sort of really dumb sectarianism that I grew up with in my school, for example. Like, I think I talk about a character in the book whose name I did change to Euclid Duddy just because I like stupid names. And he was a boy I saw in reception class. So this is 4 years old, couldn't write cat or dog, but was carving IRA into the table. Like, that's the most common thing. Like, there's probably five or six boys in the class who were the same. And that was sort of his dad. We once went over to a birthday party and he just proceeded to tell us like this very long rant about the inequities of the British and all these kinds of things. And there were people like him who would proudly say they'd never met a Protestant, which to me always seemed like a very strange thing to be proud of anyway, just apart from the morality of it. It's just like, but by happenstance, how do you know? Like, have you been asking every single person that you've ever talked to? It just seemed, it was absurd, but that's those kinds of things. They are absurd, you know, as much as they're evil and they're wrong. They're also absurd. They don't make any sense. And it's a strange lens through which to view things. And in my family's sort of situation where we were out in the sticks in a bit more of a mixed environment. And also my mum and dad were very, very committed to Christian fellowship. So my parents were very Catholic, but also were constantly involved with sort of cross-community organisations. So things like the Ulster Project, Cari Mila in Ballycastle, which we used to go to every year, and like members of my family became part of the seed group in there. And, you know, it was kind of very much with a Christian focus, and with myself and my brothers and sisters not really being particularly religious compared to my parents. But we realised even at the time how different it was, and subsequently how lucky we were, because we got to see, you know, the Alistairs and the Margarets and the people with different names and different traditions than we did. And they got to meet a few Seamuses and Kivas and Dervlas. And as asinine as that sounds, and as much as it sounds like, I don't know, like a mural on the side of a community centre where there's a kid in a Celtic shirt and a kid in a Rangers shirt and a little dove flying over them, it was really rare. And I knew that because when I go back to school, people would be mystified that I would choose to do that. And they'd have absolutely no frame of reference for it. That being said, going into secondary school, things had kind of changed a bit, and there was a lot of more cross-community stuff through the church and through the schools. And I think it became more usual, but there was a sort of, I don't want to say earned, but learned paranoia, especially in Derry, in a place which had been so stepped on, you know, for so long. And absolutely, you'd be in dereliction of your mental faculties not to feel aggrieved as a Derry person, because they had been so, like, we had been so neglected and had kind of been turned into a punching bag. But there was also sort of a funny side to that. So, I mean, the example I use in the book is I once rang up the Central Library in Derry, and I said I wanted to get this book of, I think, some horror stories by Harlan Ellison. And I said, oh, do you have, I'm 11 years old, by the way, I'm like, oh, do you have this book of Harlan Ellison ghost stories I saw there? And I rang them up and I said, hi, is this the Central Library? And the woman on the phone said, depends. Who's asking? Which is a very, very funny thing to say in any context, but to an 11-year-old, when you work for a public body, it's and that's one of the things that I find, like, that humour of that, the absurdity of that, because I think as sad and as tragic and as terrible as so much of this history is, there's such an absurdity to it that there's also there is a humour to it, and there's a warmth to it almost, and this, we're all in this together. We've all gone a little bit mad, and it's much better, hopefully, that maybe people who were there get to tell those stories rather than the sort of schlocky Hollywood types, because, you know, if you can just tread that little line and find the humour without sort of making it glib and flippant, then yeah, I think it's really worth exploring.
You're listening to Borderlines. We'll continue our conversation with Seamus O'Reilly after this short break.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
the podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Borderlines. Today we're talking to Seamus O'Reilly. Seamus, can you talk a little bit about memory? Obviously, it's a huge part of your book and the precious fragments of memory that you have about your mother, and you've written very movingly about those. You've spoken also about memories that are maybe not really your own memories, like the idea of the bomb that went off at the top of your road and the sink ending up in your field. You don't actually remember that yourself, but it was kind of passed down through family lore, and likewise the little boy who you mentioned carving IRA into his desk, you know, he has memories that are not his memories, they're inherited memories. Have you thought much on that or reflected on that much?
Especially in the book. So the book Did You Hear Mammy Died, available everywhere, it is by virtue of the fact that it's basically written between the ages of 6 and 11 in my life. So as hubristic as it is for a 35-year-old person to bring out a memoir in the first place, bringing out one which covers about 6 years of your childhood is really, really taking the biscuit. But it means that I had to really dredge through an awful lot of stuff that I knew about, that I'd heard about, and stuff that I did actively remember, but with glimpses, because, you know, memory being what it is. And the example I've given time and time again is that I remember my first taste of a banana sandwich, like, so clearly, but I don't remember being told that my mum died, like, the very moment. I remember a few hours later, and I remember the wake and bits of the funeral, but even the story that forms the title of the book, where I was found greeting people at the wake, you know, with my hand outstretched, 4 foot tall, saying, "Did you hear Mammy died?" Because I didn't really understand that death was permanent, and I was horrifying these people with my glib flippancy. I don't remember doing that. I remember every subsequent time that my family have sort of mocked me for doing it in the 30 years since. But there's loads of stuff like that I've had to go through. It's the good thing about having 10 brothers and sisters, I guess, is that you do have 10 little external hard drives that you can kind of mine for sort of samizdat. But it means that they've got an awful lot of compromat on me, really. So, you know, there's nothing that I could ask which wouldn't end up in some embarrassing story about myself, about them, about some other, you know, unnamed party in our family. And it just means that you've got all these different strands of memory, and also people violently disagreeing about very, very simple things, you know, things which you would presume there was just one answer. Like when my dad rang home from Belfast, where he'd went to greet my mum's body, he rang home at like 5 or 6 in the morning, because he'd had to go at like 3 or 4 in the morning, I believe. And he had to ring home and tell the oldest in the family basically what had happened. So to expect him to come home, blah, blah, blah. Half the family remember it as my sister Sinead picking up the phone. Half them remember it as Dara. Dara himself isn't sure. And you're like, that would surely be the most memorable thing that's ever happened to anyone. But even that, because memory is clouded by pain, memory is clouded by time, obviously. It's clouded by false suggestions. It's clouded by every single time that you remember something, you're actually remembering the last time you remembered it. So memory is a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. And this is particularly well proven by the fact that I start this one chapter of the book talking about how I only have 5 memories of my mum. And over the course of writing the book, I find 3 more. So, you know, if nothing else, apart from obviously all the fame and fortune that writing a book gives you, I've got 60% more of my mum, kind of, you know, which is, you know, that's a real head melt. If you start thinking about that, well, if I hadn't written this book, would I never have recovered those memories? Or, you know, in another sense, if I didn't write this book, I'd know my family so much less, you know. We're quite a close, huggy, chatty family. We're very loud. We love to sit around and tell stories and, you know, take the mickey out of each other. That's how we show our love, and we do it on a very regular basis. But there were still so many things I'd never asked. I never asked my brother Shane, what was the wake like for you? And he told me a story about how my sister Dervla, she cried so much at the funeral that her shoe fell off. And that the cause and effect of that just always just shocked me. I was like, she cried so much her shoe came off. So I was like, oh, if I'd never asked you about this, I wouldn't have possibly my favorite description in the entire book. And things like that gave me a license. It was almost like I had a little, you know, I had a little Stetson with like, you know, the little bit of tape that says press on it, you know, in like a 1930s TV show. Cause I was able to go up to my family and ask all these quite invasive questions, but I was like, oh, it's for the book. So I'd ring them up at a random 4 p.m. on a Tuesday and be like, yeah, do you remember we went to like this, to Mosny that time? And like, was I bitten by a dog? And all of a sudden, no, what you're, it wasn't you. You were actually bitten by a donkey. The horse happens, you know, and you'd get, everything would just spiral out. And having all those external hard drives of memory is really good because it makes it a better book, but it makes you really come away with the thought that memory itself is so fragile and movable that it's kind of shocking in a way. So I would recommend it if anyone is writing a memoir that they have 10 brothers and sisters, because it does, having a few extra external hard drives is really useful.
I'm sure it's very bittersweet though, Seamus. I mean, it must be, as you say, extraordinary to unearth those memories that must have been suppressed. I'm sure it was very painful for you and some of your siblings.
I mean, it was. I mean, the memories were, they were so banal as well. I mean, they were lovely for me to have them, but they were, you know, it was literally like driving down a road. I think her talking to one of my teachers. And then I think it was us late at night in a caravan in Westport. And, you know, so like not exactly blockbuster moments of high drama, but it was very bittersweet. And there were parts of it which were, because I'm getting used to being bereaved so young, it just becomes part of your story. And, you know, you just kind of rattle it off. And I go into that in the book as well. So as a way of protecting myself and also protecting the people I'm talking to, because you don't want them to think that they're offending you. So I get it all out and I say, yes, I've got 10 brothers and sisters, but actually my mom died when I was 5, blah, 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 blah. Just so that they don't step in it at some point, because there's like 4 or 5 hinge points while I'm talking about my family where they could say something about my mum having had all those kids, and then I'd say, well, actually she died, and then they feel bad. So it's become this thing which is just second nature. It's rote in my head, and having to actually dig in there and actually feel so sad for this little boy who was me, that was new, kind of. And also the flip side of that, now that I'm a parent myself, how much deeper my sadness and sorrow was for my dad and for my mum. Like, I never really thought about it from my mum's perspective. She knew she was dying. She was leaving 11 kids behind. And in all the different layers of grief and sadness and anger I've ever had, I'd almost never thought about what she felt like. Like, she was leaving these kids behind, that she wasn't going to see them grow up, that she was, you know, abandoning them, maybe she could have thought of at some point, you know. She must have had good days and bad days. And those kinds of considerations were kind of more rare to me until I started like reading her letters and seeing all the people who knew her at that time and what they saw her going through. And, you know, it's useful to go through the harder stuff, especially because I write generally funny stuff and I try to make those bits earned. But the trouble with doing that is you have, in order to earn it, the pay that you have to sort of wage is that you have to get into the deep stuff as well. And you have to actually talk about how sad you are and still are and angry you still are. And if you don't do that, then you've kind of shortchanged yourself and your readers. So it was really, really worth doing. And it was pretty much, the whole process was about, I'm going to earn this. I want the balance to be there. I want it to be as sad as it was, and I want it to be as funny as it was. And that meant kind of having a bit of discipline about it.
And I'm sure one thing was that you maybe saw your parents as a couple and not just as parents, which obviously was a big part of their life. But you have the beautiful scene of, you know, your dad dancing with your mom with a rose between his teeth, and all the kids are screaming and squealing and cringing and mortified and embarrassed, but loving it.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really love that one because it's just silly. And also, I think it's one of those things that whenever people do talk about that part of the book, they're like, oh my God, that's exactly what my parents would do. They just try and embarrass us and, kind of making kissy faces. And I think my dad had a rose between his teeth because he was like, I think he was showing off. I think it must have been like Valentine's Day or a birthday or something. And we were all cackling with disgust And but it was just a nice little moment as well, because it showed them as a couple. And God forbid that they would show that they love each other. You know, how disgusting of them to, you know, the fact that they had 11 kids should have been a bit of a suggestion that they were, you know, fond of each other at least. And like those kinds of moments are very precious. They're very, you know, little moments of silliness. I think especially because when you're a kid, you probably think that your parents are kind of stern and they're adults and they're boring. And, you know, I certainly did in my case. And then you look back and you're like, they were just, he was probably my age then. Like, you know, it's kind of horrible to think, but yeah.
We're talking about memory and memoirs and sort of and the need to write about this and how it's allowed you, I think, to excavate other memories and to explore all of that. And I think one of the things that's really interesting is how there are other writers of around your age from Derry who've been writing memoirs recently. I mean, I'm thinking of Darren Anderson's Inventory, Kearney Doherty, Thin Places. You know, there are others as well across Northern Ireland. And I'm wondering, what is it about this generation now that you feel the need to write about what was experienced? I don't know if it was a personal thing for you, but there does seem to be a, I don't want to say a movement to that too much, but there's something about this generation now that this is happening, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I adored Inventory by Darren Anderson. I did an event with him for... we're both featured on the New Frontiers, the New Ireland collection of border writing, which came out there in September or October. And he made a really, really interesting point about, you know, excavating memory and putting these things into place as, you know, even something like, for example, remembering the checkpoints and the barracks, which have all now been pulled down. And most people, I think, would agree that that's probably a good thing, that, you know, the demilitarization has happened. And it was something, in fact, that people from myself and Darren's community anyway, were very sort of agitated about. But he made an interesting point. He said, to some extent, it would be good if some of them still stood, gathering moss, you know, gathering sort of like decay, so that people could never say that it wasn't there. And we even remember, like, 3 or 4 years ago, the Brexit Party MEPs who would come and say that there was never a hard border in Ireland. You know, I mean... There simply was. What are you talking about? But, you know, if you kind of remove the things, and he talked about like sort of post-Soviet places where, you know, things that were put up as, you know, kind of, you know, these kind of tyrannical kind of separations of people and like sort of military installations and walls, some of them have been preserved and kept almost in place as art projects or as a, you know, we must not forget this. Whereas in the scramble to build something like a better future in Northern Ireland, whether or not that has actually transpired, but in the scramble to achieve that, a lot of it has been forgotten. It's been memory hold. So I think maybe if there's something that unites a lot of the works that you're referring to, it might be that. It might be the fact that people are saying, this happened. You know, this was just absolutely part of the everyday experience of people all over the country, and particularly in border areas specifically. But it was completely memory hold. It was not something that people ever talked about outside of very specific things about a specific massacre, a specific person, a specific story. It's like, no, but it was like just going to the shops. It was there. It was going to visit your cousins. It was there. It was having the wrong surname and being pulled out of your house at 4 a.m. You know, it was there. And to some extent, it gets to this other thing, which I find, I did a creative writing workshop once very long time ago. I was working for Fighting Words with Roddy Doyle. Not with Roddy Doyle. Roddy Doyle just runs it. I think I met him once. But it was a sort of a TV writing thing. It was like, they brought a guy in and I was just taking part as a punter. And I suggested something about Northern Ireland. And he said to me, very thoughtfully, he's, you know, went over it and said, I usually hate stuff with Northern Ireland. I just, you know, it gives me food poisoning. And I was like, all of Northern Ireland. But he felt free to say that. And it was kind of this idea that it's all we ever talk about. Jesus, would you never give over? And it's like, well, actually, we don't really. I think the shocking thing about Northern Irish people is we don't talk about it more. It's just that whenever people give us printing contracts and whenever people ask us about certain things, well, obviously we're not going to refuse to speak. To some extent, there still hasn't been a proper reckoning of what happened. And there's 100,000 people still living in Northern Ireland who lost an immediate family member. So you're talking about PTSD on a grand scale. I think there's a lot of denial. And then on top of that, you've got just other issues that are still completely connected. So the, you know, the poverty and the disenfranchisement that you see in Derry to this day. I think Derry is ranked 47th out of 47 cities in the UK mm-hmm. in terms of its commercial outlook and its, you know, opportunities, particularly for young people. So you have to talk about that stuff if you're going to talk about anything. And my book is mostly just about growing up with a big family and, you know, my dad knowing loads of priests and taking a trip to Spain in a minibus and caravan that together were about as long as Liberty Hall, you know, all, but it happened in Northern Ireland. So that stuff does creep in. And I think the reason maybe that people are talking about it is because those people are writing books and, you know, why wouldn't they? Another one to recommend, by the way, is by Stephen Sexton, If All the World and Love Were Young. It's a beautiful book of poetry about the death of his mother, which is also about Super Mario for the SNES. So I try to recommend it anytime I can because it's an absolutely beautiful book and everyone should read it.
On your own work, Seamus, you referenced your contribution to New Frontier, and that's you dipping your toe into fiction and writing from the perspective of a character who's not part of a big family, which must have been a real creative stretch for you. But what's next for you in that regard? Is that where you see yourself go next in your career into fiction?
Well, I've just done a 10-part series for BBC Radio 4, so that is currently airing. You can listen to it in the UK or in Ireland completely for free on the Sounds app or just on the BBC player. It's called Bright Lights, Dead City. It's a 10-part drama series, sort of satire basically of a sort of big production company, maybe like a Netflix kind of a thing, comes into Derry to make a drama, a prestige drama about the Troubles. And it's about the gleeful microclimate of extortion that kind of envelops them as they come to town and find that everybody's got a story and everybody wants to get involved. So it's kind of an exploration of that. It is fictional. It draws on loads of sort of well-worn things that people from Derry or anywhere in Northern Ireland will know. And also anybody who's watched enough depictions of Northern Ireland made by perhaps well-meaning but slightly dense outsiders. So I have very, very much enjoyed writing fiction. It's kind of hair-pulling a lot of the time. But then sometimes when you're writing memoir, you're just like, it would be so handy if I could just make this all up. But then you're writing fiction, you're like, it'd be so handy if I could just remember this. just sit and do some remembering. It's a bit, you know, I don't know which one I prefer. I always prefer the other when I'm doing the one. And there may or may not be adapting of the book for a visual medium, but I can't really say very much about that. So yes, I'm enjoying all of the new things. As for book two in a memoir-y shape, that could be on the cards as well, because it does end when I'm about 11. So I didn't just go into cold storage. I did have, you know, an extra life that went on beyond that point. So who knows? But watch this space. That's what I'll say.
Before we let you go, we better ask you, Seamus, how Daddy is reacting to his fame at this stage.
Oh, he is loving it. He's kind of been upset that it's died down a bit because the book came out in July. And so he was the center of attention for a good while, as he should be and almost always is. But it was the best thing was just getting loads of calls from people he hadn't seen in a while, and people would be picking up the book and bringing it home and reading it and getting two pages in and realizing, oh, that's Joe, I used to work with him or whatever. So that was really nice. And also, you know, Marion Key saying she was falling in love with him, which she was very pleased about. So those kinds of things are nice. But he's been very, very supportive of it. One of the best things about the whole process was that I got to go home about 2-3 weeks before the book was actually published and read it, some of it to him. And he really enjoyed it. He laughed at the right bits. He didn't want to kill me. I was sweating, obviously, because it was like, oh, what if he hates this? But he did. So I think I realized, since the book is largely a love letter to him, and self-consciously so, it, once I realized that he was okay with its contents, everything else was just a bonus. So yeah, he's doing well.
Brilliant. Glad to hear it. Seamus O'Reilly, author of Did You Hear Mammy Died? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week, we're talking to the author Jan Carson, whose book The Raptures is out now.
That's on Borderlines every Monday from me, Freya McClements.
And me, Mary Minahan, and our producer, Declan Conlon. Thank you for listening and goodbye for now.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.